Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Vivian Stockman. She's project coordinator for the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, which is based in Huntington, West Virginia. Stockman's photos of mountaintop removal and the movement to stop this extreme coal mining practice have been published in newspapers, magazines, books, and documentaries on websites. Publications credits include New York Times, Washington Monthly, Orion Magazine, World Watch Magazine, E! Magazine, French Geo, and dozens more. She's assisted with, consulted for, and been filmed for several documentaries, including Time to Choose, The Last Mountain, Burning the Future, Goodbye Golly Mountain, and others. So first, of course, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program again.
Well, thanks for having me back.
So last time we talked about mountaintop removal, and this time we're going to talk about coal slurry injection and also coal sludge dams. And those are, so can you basically do like a 5-minute recap for those who didn't hear the first interview about what is mountaintop removal, and then we'll move into the other.
Sure. Okay, so in a sort of toxic nutshell, I guess, mountaintop removal, it's really an ecocidal type of coal mining practice where the coal companies blast away the tops of these forested mountains around here to get to the thin seams of coal underneath the mountains. And one author said we should really be calling it mountain range removal because it's so extensive. And it's annihilating our ecosystems here. And we have some of the most biologically diverse temperate forests in the world. And after mountaintop coal mining, these forests turn into, they become barren moonscapes, essentially. So there's these thin layers of valuable low-sulfur coal under the mountains, and they're too narrow to be mined by the traditional method. So what the coal companies do is sort of raise the forest, scrape away the topsoil, and they usually don't even save that, or, you know, any potential former trees, potential lumber. And then, of course, the understory herbs are just like ginseng and golden seal are annihilated too. And then they use explosives to blast, you know, it can be about up to 800 feet off the tops of the mountains. And these explosives that they're using, ANFO, ammonium nitrate fuel oil, is, and sort of all these dangerous catalysts, they're the, if you recall the Oklahoma City, the federal building bombing, the blasts that they're using in these to blow up the mountains are up to 100 times as strong as that particular blast. And, of course, that creates loads of rubble, which the companies are calling the former mountaintops overburden. And all that overburden is pushed into the valleys and buries the, you know, biologically crucial headwater streams. And it's not just wrecking the ecosystems. Of course, any communities living nearby are having all sorts of problems. There's blasting that does all sorts of damage to homes and ruins water wells and sort of plays havoc with people's health. And then there's even this fly boulder coming off, or fly rock, they call it. I call it fly boulder because they can be so huge, coming off the mountains onto the communities below. And the dust that's generated from this activity is laden with silica. So it's basically little tiny glass particles going through the air and other, you know, assorted minerals and metals that you would find in coal and the layers of rock are being pulverized, put into the air. And of course, that's endangering people's health. And there's even a study that directly links mountaintop removal to human health impacts. And of course, it's not just the, you know, community suffering, or not only the community suffering, but any inhabitants of the forest. It's kind of your whole habitat's destroyed, so you're left with pretty much a moonscape. So that's mountaintop removal, and you know, that's just one of the whole host of sort of ecocidal problems that we have associated with the mining and burning of coal. And of course, one of the problems we have is the liquid waste and what to do with that. And that's sort of what we said we'd talk about here today. And of course, you know, I think a lot of people might be familiar with the fairly recent coal ash disasters, like in Kingston, Tennessee, in the late 2000s, and more recently on the Dan River in North Carolina and Virginia. Now, those disasters, completely man-made disasters, were from the coal ash that's left over from burning the coal, and these are causing huge contamination problems. But what we're looking at today, or talking about today, is sort of on the other end of that process, is when the coal is mined, it's got to be cleaned for market, because especially with the traditional deep mining, you know, you're not just bringing up coal, you're bringing up rock, soil, other debris in the mining process. And of course, the power companies want pure coal, and the coal companies don't want to pay for shipping anything other than coal. So before they send it off to market, they clean it and prep it at things that are called coal prep plants. And so the coal prep plants are generating huge volumes of liquid waste. And what goes on at the prep plants is that the coal is separated from any of non-combustible debris. And to do that, the prep plants use water, of course, and put the coal in that, and then they add any one of probably up to 100 different types of chemicals, flocculants and surfactants, things that are used to separate the coal from the debris. And we've had a real hard time finding out what all those chemicals are, because, you know, the companies will invoke these trade secrets, say that's a trade secret and we can't tell you about it. But our group, the group I work for, OVEC, and another group, Coal River Mountain Watch, we worked with coal slurry impacted community members in southern West Virginia, and we have this sludge safety project. And we were able to find out some of the things that are used, some of the chemicals used in the coal prep plants. And basically, they're a bunch of nasty carcinogenic type of chemicals. Acrylamides is one of them. And so the waste that's generated, and this liquid waste generated at these coal prep plants, you know, they say they dispose of it. Of course, we know there's really no such thing as disposal, because there's no a way, you know, here on Earth you can't get rid of it. So they have two different methods of storing the waste. And one is in these lakes of, you know, they're really lakes. They're huge. They call them coal sludge ponds, but they're lakes. They're massive. And they store the waste behind these earthen dams. And the earthen dams, a lot of times there's the debris brought up by the mines. And they also store it by injection underground. And, you know, as I recount some of the stories around this two ways of, you know, quote-unquote disposing of the slurry, you'll see basically the end result of sort of the greed of the coal companies and also the politicians they fund. There's some disastrous stories.
So before we get to those stories, can you say, like, how big a typical reservoir would be? You said they're big. How big?
Right.
And then how big would be, like, the biggest one you know of? A typical one and the biggest one.
Okay. Well, they're usually – well, I couldn't say usually. There's all different sizes, and I've seen a lot of them from the air. It's really hard to get access to them from the ground, but from the air, when we go on aerial photography trips, you know, you can see a lot of them, and they really are lakes. Probably quite a few of them are on the scale of a couple of hundred acres. The biggest one is Massey Energy, or the former Massey Energy, Marfork Coal, Brushy Fork impoundment. And this is just looms over the town of Whitesville. And I think the total acreage that it's permitted for is something like 650 some acres. And that they do have what they call incidental boundary reviews, where they can add more to it. So it may be more. That was pretty much its original permitting 650-some acres, and it would hold a total of 8 billion gallons of slurry. So, I mean, that's definitely the largest slurry impoundment in state history, and the dam itself, the waste rock dam, the earthen dam, is taller than the New River Gorge Bridge, you know, the height from the river to the bridge, which that is more than 900 feet. So, the bridge is close to 900 feet. The dam itself, I think, is like 920-some feet. So it's probably about 50 feet higher than the gorge. So, you know, you're talking a massive structure operated by the notorious, you know, former Massey Energy, now Alpha, which is bankrupt. So this, you know, this tidal, the potential tidal wave of sludge is looming over the town of Whitesville, West Virginia. And that's the biggest one. So, you know, we're talking large structures. And people might remember, well, at least in our area, people know about the Buffalo Creek disaster. And that happened in 1972. And that was a series of coal sludge dams. And they were much more shoddily constructed then than now. But still, we're still talking about, you know, earthen dams holding back these massive lakes of toxic glop. But that Buffalo Creek disaster was in Logan County, West Virginia. And that was about 130-some hundred thousand gallons of the coal slurry broke through the dams when there had been several days of rain. And it just went down this highly populated holler with like a tidal wave that was about 30 feet high. And in the end, about 125 people were killed and more than 1,000 were injured and about 4,000 were made homeless. And, you know, the whole tragedy was entirely preventable. And ultimately, it helped lead to the passage of some mining safety laws and the 1977 law we call SMACRA, the Surface Mining Reclamation and Control, Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. And about the time that law was passed and in the wake of this, you know, just insane disaster, a lot of people were advocating for a total ban on strip mining, but this law became a sort of compromise. And, you know, it's still in place today. And, you know, most of us, I could say everybody in the network that I work with would have preferred the ban on strip mining, and we wouldn't have to be talking about mountaintop removal and these type of things. So, you know, this is a compromise, but if it happened to have been enforced, we'd be better off. But, well, the lack of enforcement's another topic, really. But so, you know, the Buffalo Creek coal sludge dam disaster was definitely the worst in the United States, anyway, in terms of lives taken. And but still today, there's problems with these things. There's, of course, frequent spills from the coal prep plant where, you know, black water surges down a creek and chokes out life. But there was a more recent sort of catastrophic failure of a coal sludge dam, which was in October 2000 in Kentucky. There was another Massey Energy operated, you know, different subsidiary of Massey Energy, but they had a dam there that one. I think it was slated for a total of, it contained about 2 billion gallons total of coal sludge, but, and it was built, there's laws, but the laws were just, you know, basically flagrantly disregarded because there's supposed to be about 100 feet between the bottom of one of these impoundments and you know, any underlying mines. Well, there, and, you know, so there's supposed to be 100 feet of solid rock at least to hold the weight of the dam. Well, and this was not the case, and this part of this impoundment was very close to some old underground deep mines, and, you know, a crack opened up, and more than 300 million gallons of sludge burst out, you know, oozed down into the underground mine and burst out mine portals into two different waterways, and it went about 100 miles down these waterways and communities along the Big Sandy and Tug Rivers, and you know, those two feed into the Ohio, and it's kind of on the border of Kentucky and West Virginia, and communities along there had to temporarily shut down their water intakes, and I think even an oil refinery had to shut down for a while, and Kentucky officials said there was like a total kill of aquatic life along this big area, and just, you know, just no humans died, fortunately, but it was pretty bad for aquatic life. And, you know, that's like, at the time, I can remember, a lot of us were pretty upset just about the coverage of it because, you know, the Exxon Valdez spill was like 11 million gallons. This was more than 300 million gallons. And you know, it was kind of, we kind of felt like, oh, well, it's Appalachia. The rest of the country doesn't really need to know about it, was sort of the attitude of the media, it seemed like. I mean, our local media, of course, were covering it, but we didn't feel like it got much national attention. But so, you know, these, I just, as an aside, you know, these two, the this was a Massey Energy impoundment, and I don't know if you've been hearing in the news about Don Blankenship, the former CEO of Massey Energy. He's due to report to prison for a year sentence on May 12th unless his appeal goes through, and that's on another mine-related, but not related to sludge matter, related to an explosion at a mine that killed 29 miners. But, I mean, his charges aren't – I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's pretty classic that a CEO kills 29 people, and we're lucky that he got a year. And
right, and the charges weren't even about the death. They were about that he, you know, the main part of the charge was that he lied to securities in exchange, you know, so it was about defrauding the investors with, you know, so.
Well, a couple jokes I used to tell that aren't very funny, a couple riddles. One of them is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. And the other is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, 8,000 dead human beings, and the answer to retirement with full pay and benefits.
Yeah, that's not, it's that's Bhopal. Sad but true. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another story. We have the Bhopal chemical stored here, but nearby, or we did until a near disaster recently. But
okay, so you have these big dams that hold behind them inconceivable amounts of coal sludge, which is toxic. And I have to ask this. I mean, so basically that makes, you said one of them was 600 and some acres. So that's a square mile of, as well as harming everything downstream when they leak, that's a square mile that has been completely killed, right?
I mean,
I mean, so what happens if waterfowl land on it? What happens if frogs try to swim down to the, or to hop down to the edge?
Well,
I mean, I'm presuming that these things, it's like a cyanide heap leach pond or something. I'm presuming that these things have no life in them, essentially, right?
Yeah, there's, you know, the coal company will say that, you know, the whole point of them is that the crap settles out and there's supposed to be a nice layer on top. And, you know, it's hard to get up close to them. I've had, like, through assorted, you know, channels, I've had, you know, legal channels, I've had actual access to some of these sites. And, like, the Brushy Fork one, you know, I mean, you could, like, smell fumes coming off of it, and I didn't see any sign of wildlife. And now another one in Mingo County that, you know, went up to with a lawyer and client and to look at, you know, it was a nasty color, but I think that, you know, there were some wildlife visiting in it, but, you know, I do not think that it would be good for them over the long term. And
let's point out explicitly, let's just point out very explicitly that these are communities, like the dam is above a town, you've mentioned, and I forget the name of the town, but
Whitesville, right.
Whitesville, and So these people's lives are dependent on this. It's presumably affecting their groundwater, and yet they have no access to it. They can't walk up and, I mean, you'd think that if there is something that is going to possibly kill you, at the very, 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 very least, the public should be able to have direct access to this thing that might kill them.
You would think, Derek, you would think, but yeah, no, these are gated off. There's, you know, the only way I've been able to get there is like through a lawsuit or with a lawyer, or, you know, to ask the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection through a formal process for a site visit. Now, there are some brave folks who have, you know, done things like, you know, snuck onto these sites and launched kayaks out on them and unfurled banners and stuff, and you know, so you risk a risk if you want to approach one by any other means than going through a bunch of rigmarole and having, you know, lawyers help and yeah, but yeah, and getting the data about what the hell is really in this and what could possibly be leaching into your groundwater, you know, and I mean, that's sort of, you know, that sort of is a good segue into the other way to dispose of it, because, you know, here you have this these dams that have, you know, the potential for and have killed people instantaneously with failure, or have and created huge property damage, and, you know, not to mention the never used to be living there. But so, you know, those can be that sort of instantaneous death, but there's this other method that they, you know, quote unquote, dispose of the coal slurry, that's this slow motion disaster that really has also killed people, but it's sickened them and shortened their lives. And that's where they inject the coal slurry underground to, you know, dispose of it. And we can look at another Massey Energy case in Mingo County. There's Rawl Sales and Processing that used to be a Massey company. And over the years, that, you know, with DEP's permitted permission, that company injected billions of gallons of the liquid coal prep plant waste underground to out of sight, out of mind, I guess. And it was injecting it into old abandoned deep mines. And, you know, the standard sort of, I don't know, delusion that the company and the regulators told themselves was that, you know, it was staying there. You know, liquid injected underground into a cavern, well, it's just going to stay there. You know, there's no fissures or anything like that. So, of course, that wasn't the case. And so these folks living near this coal prep plant in the Mingo County communities, it was Rawl, Lick Creek, Merrimack, and Sprigg, the names of some of the most heavily impacted communities. And almost all the folks in these communities, I don't think there was at all city water, any kind of piped-in water. So everybody had private water wells. And, you know, everybody had, for a long time, had these private water wells, and person after person that spoke with down there and, you know, visited their homes and all that used to have really good well water. But as one person whose house, one person who was a coal miner who worked in the coal prep plant, you know, one day he was turning on his tap and he's like, that looks like coal fines, you know, little particle of coal coming out of my tap. And that was sort of the first indication that something was wrong. Well, the well water in the area just got horrifying, just black, orange, and smelling like rotten eggs. And, you know, the people began to, you know, talk amongst themselves, and every house up and down, just in these little communities, in every house there was somebody with some kind of illness, you know, like liver, brain, just, you know, all kinds of ailments, and even kids with, you know, grown-ups diseases and things that wouldn't, like gallbladder issues or something, you know, and it, you know, I mean, anybody with common sense could see that the water was poisoning the people. And, you know, if I went into a home there, some friends that live in Raw, and out this woman's kitchen window, while she's washing her dishes in the dirty, disgusting water, she looks up the hill and sees Don Blankenship, sort of Edward Scissorhands' nutty castle. He's up. His address is also Rawl or Sprigg. I forget what it's called, but he's on the mountain up there. And he, as soon as that mansion was built up there, which there's nothing else up on the mountains anywhere. It's just too hard, too costly to build on top of a mountain. He builds on top of a mountain. He gets piped in water up there. And there he is, like, what's his name in The Simpsons, you know, rubbing his hand, the industrialist. He's looking down on the communities he's poisoning, you know. So she's got to sit there and wash or stand there and wash her dishes looking up at this guy's mansion. And meanwhile, he's poisoning him, an aquatic biologist who is down there taking tests and met up with this particular woman. And such, at that particular time, she had classic signs of arsenic poisoning. And, you know, people might say, well, if their water's so poisoned, why didn't they just, you know, bring in other water? Well, first of all, the community and the groups like ours, it was 14 years of agitating before they got piped in water.
But piped in water is not a solution. I mean, it's
their
home.
It's not a solution.
It's their
because
home.
No, and it's not a solution because meanwhile, you know, there's still the threat from all the other coal slurry impoundments that are leaking, or the mountaintop removal valley fills that are leaching selenium. You know, the particular aquatic scientist has done a lot of testing in Mingo County. He's just totally concerned that, you know, in a few more years, there's just not going to be any potable water in Mingo County. And you know, the fumes in the homes from the organisms that were digesting this stuff in the water were creating hydrogen sulfide, which is a deadly gas. I mean, I went into these folks' homes one time, and I just asked to lay down. I laid down on their floor and took a nap. I'm a person who never takes a nap, but the fumes just overcame me. And these folks are having to live with it every single day. And they can't afford, you know, you can't afford to get replacement water for your, you know, bathing, for washing your clothes, for washing your dishes. You know, if you're lucky, you can get it for drinking. But, you know, some folks couldn't even afford that. And so even if you are lucky enough to be able to buy, you know, quote unquote, lucky to buy water to drink, you're still breathing those fumes and people were still getting sick. So, I mean, there was a class action lawsuit, or it started out as class action. It may not have finished up that way, but like 700 families were on this lawsuit. And eventually there was a settlement. So, you know, they got some compensation, but of course you cannot compensate for the people who have died or for, you know, basically never going to have sweet well water again. And just for the whole rigmarole of being treated so terribly and then having to, you know, one of the things we did was help organize people to bring them to the state capitol to demand some change there. But just, you know, watching the sliminess of the whole political process too takes a toll on folks. But, you know, that's not just one community. There's also Printer in Boone County that's been struggling with the being poisoned by this underground injection too. There's a whole class action lawsuit for coal prep plant workers, which are getting sick. These guys are getting sick and dying too, with rare bone cancers and whatnot. So, and this one of the chemicals we learned a little bit more about it. One of the chemicals used in the coal prep plants in January in 2014, and I happened to be in Charleston that day, and there was this really throat clawing, annoying, sickly, sweet licorice smell seeping out over the city. And it turned out that there was about 10,000 gallons of let me get this right, methyl cyclohexane methanol, or MCHM, that had leaked from a storage tank along the Elk River, and it leaked into the river, and about a mile and a half downstream, well, it leaked upstream and went downstream to this intake valve for West Virginia American Water Company, a privately owned water company. Another story. And it was the intake for about 300,000 people in central West Virginia. And it was hours after the leak was first detected and reported, although, you know, later it turns out it probably been leaking for quite some time. But by the time it got to that concentration where it was really that badly noticeable over a swath of the city, well, you know, it was hours later before there was finally issued a do not use the water order. And in the meantime, people, of course, had used it and were reporting, you know, some of those who had used it were reporting to the hospital with rashes and headaches and vomiting. And so it turned and it was just this big fluster cluck that went on, you know, for days. People didn't have water. It was about 9 days in some areas. Or more than a week, anyway, for about 9 counties in central West Virginia, and we still don't know what the long-term effects were. But that chemical, MCHM, the reason it was stored at that Freedom Industries tank farm along the Elk River, it was stored there because it would be distributed to coal prep plants. It was one of the coal prep plant chemicals. And, you know, when this disaster happened and we learned what that chemical was and its use was, you know I wasn't the only one that sort of had the sadly snarky thought of, you know, well, welcome to our world, because, you know, this all these people in the more urban areas of the state were exposed to what people living near the coal prep plants have to deal with on a sort of drip by drip, day-by-day basis of, you know, black water spills or even just stuff leaching slowly or failing catastrophically. So, you know, and of course, that's just one of the chemicals that are at these coal prep plants. So, you know.
You know, this all, you know, as you know, my work is about how insane this culture is. And how I deal with a lot of atrocities in my work. And this, everything you're saying, both in our previous conversation about mountaintop removal and this, is these are some of the best examples of this culture being just, everything you're saying is completely insane, the things you're describing. I mean,
it is.
And then to add to this, there's also, I mean, people get compensated, or like when you said about piping and water, this is all horrifying me because, I mean, this is people's homes, and West Virginia is also, I mean, I'm from an outsider, I've only passed through West Virginia a number of times, but it's known on the outside for many people having long, generations-long connections to the land.
That's right.
Where I remember a conversation with my friend Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian. And I was saying, how does someone become indigenous? And is an Indian who lives in Los Angeles and who's never been on their ancestral home, what's the relation? You know, I was asking her about all these questions. And one of the things she said to me is she said, you know, there are people in West Virginia who have lived in the same place for 300 years. And she said those people are, like, on their way to becoming indigenous. Give them another 500 years. I mean, they know, you know, I've talked to hunters from West Virginia some people who've hunted with people from West Virginia. The guy I'm specifically thinking of was a great hunter from Washington State, and he went hunting from somebody, and he knew what he was doing. He went hunting with somebody from West Virginia who could tell from smells. I mean, this person knows the land, knows right. The land the way you can only know the land if you've lived there for 200 years. And so these people are being – the water that they have drunk for 200 years in their family is being toxified, and the air they've been breathing for 200 years is being toxified. That's even more horrifying than if they moved in a week ago somehow. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. And, you know, like one of our organizers, Dustin White, you know, his family goes back 11 generations here, 11 generations before coal was discovered here, you know. And people really do have a strong root to the land. And, you know, I know I've attended some organizing workshops or, you know, places where you meet people from other cultures or, you know, other areas dealing with these kind of, you know, the insane impacts of this extraction mentality. And, you know, one of the things in talking to the people, I realized, you know, we are forest dwellers here. And the land, you know, the land is a partner in life. And then when you're denied access to it, and like you say, when you know, and it's insane. I mean, I may have said this the last time, was like how it just strikes me daily that we are in a position, those of us who are, you know, speaking up about this or trying to bring about some change, we're in a position where we're criticized, you know, as job killers or you know, and all, that's the nice part, the nice term. You know, why do we even have to stand up and say this is wrong and crazy, you know? I don't understand. But, you know, and I guess, you know, we get these small victories, you know, like you said, like we get the little consolation prize of some piped in, still probably toxic, but not as toxic water. And we get something, we did manage to get now there's a law that bans any new underground injection of coal slurry. But, you know, we're still, like, far from the ultimate victory of stopping all this insanity. And you know, when we have that victory, the thing of it is, you know, it's not going to be a victory unless the people that are so dependent on, you know, on this mining right now, you know, that there's something to help us as we transition out of the carbon economy and get into the, you know, the low carbon era. So, you know, there's got to be some justice for the folks that have lived here.
So I'm going to ask you a question that I hate this when I see other people ask this question, but I'm going to do it anyway. Describe for people who don't live in West Virginia, as I mean, you've been doing it for this hour and for the previous hour, but describe for them what it is like to lose your home, to lose the larger. I'm not talking about a house. I'm talking about the entire forest. I mean, describe that to somebody who hasn't experienced that. Who hasn't been in the forest and lived in a place that this is my home.
Yeah, I mean, so there's so much to home in West Virginia that we call it home place, you know, so it's not just about the dwelling you're in, it's about the historical connection of your, you know, your ancestors who passed down the property where you're living now, and about the ways in which the land and the water sustain you, so that you're, you know, even though you're cash poor, you know, you don't feel deprived. You feel rich because you have, you know, you have the bird song, you have the forest to provide, from firewood to furniture to, you know, meat or, you know, Molly Moochers, which morels. Or, you know, so there's the grocery store of the woods. So all these things that are, you know, you would have to pay for in the city are just given to you by the land. And the land is, you know, as long as you are respectful and appreciative, you know, you can work together, and the land is a family member. And I mean, the sense of place is just immense. If somebody who's like traveled around a lot or been moved place to place, you know, you don't have that rootedness, that connectedness, and to lose that, to have it just yanked away from you, and not only, you know, it might be one thing if it's no longer in your family's possession, but you know it's still there, but for it to be just obliterated, to have this lush near paradise type of landscape just obliterated, you know, that's like, it's like your heart's gone too. That's a member of your family. So I mean, it's and the community of, you know, and when you have this rootedness, you know, too, you've got neighbors, you've got community, you know, you've got people you can depend on. And when those, when the whole community is just wiped off the map because it can't stay there anymore because, you know, the land's gone, the mountain's blown up, the water's poisoned, you know, that's a huge loss to no longer have community.
So now let's go a different direction. Let's pretend that you were able to stop all production of, forget the coal for a second, you're able to stop all production of coal slurry. There is no more coal slurry that is made in West Virginia. And what would you do about the current mines filled with coal slurry, and what would you do about the reservoirs of coal slurry? What would you do about the existing stuff if they, and suddenly you don't have to worry about politics either. You're like suddenly made the queen of all things coal slurry. How would you fix that problem, presuming it's fixable?
I'd put it in the mansions of certain politicians and coal barons.
Well, there you go.
Well, that would be my nasty, rude side that would do that. But, you know, I mean, there's
my point is, presuming that people were actually of good heart and wanted to fix it and didn't hate the earth and want to destroy the earth, presuming all of that, mm-hmm. what, and presuming once again that no more, then obviously the first thing to do was not make any more of this poison. But what can be done about the poison that's there? Anything? Or is this just, you know, you take your great, 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 you know, your great, great, great grandchildren go to it and say, look how stupid these people were. Is that what this remains? Or is it, or is there, there's a line from after Bhopal, there was an activist doctor there who said, no one should be allowed to make a poison for which there is no antidote. And that's one of the problems with this culture. This culture keeps making poisons for which there is no antidotes. So my question first is there anything to be done about that, presuming that we were of good heart? And if so, what would it be?
Well,
or is this just,
you'd have
is this
to stop it from,
forever?
We have to stop it from leaching. So, you know, you have to, you know, I mean, the coal companies will say that these ponds will, you know, there'll be so much stuff in it that they'll eventually harden up and, you know, you should be able to, like, I don't know, put a playground on, you know, put 400 playgrounds on one side or something.
But the bottom of a reservoir is, or bottom of a lake is alive too. That's where a lot of the life is. So
if there's
a hard crust at the bottom, it's going to be toxified forever.
Yeah, I don't know how you stop it from leaching. You know, I mean that's like with coal ash. You know, the post combustion product. You know, they're putting that in drywall or cement or something. You know, so they're trying somehow to sequester it. But you know, there is no away. You know, I mean we can
and how
put
much
it on
this
spaceships
stuff?
And blow it out of the atmosphere. You know,
how much? Okay, so you've talked about billions of gallons. Do you have any idea how much coal slurry is being produced every year?
No, not off the top of my head.
I mean, can you give just a makeup estimate?
Well,
I mean, the stuff's still being produced, right?
Right. But see, one thing that's happening is that there's more and more plants that are going to a dry press method, which they, you know, press their using less water, and so it was presumably less stuff leaching into streams and underground aquifers, but you know, you still have the solid waste. But you know, you consider one company raw sales over a decade pumped billions and billions of gallons in to the ground. You know, I don't know the volume. I'm not sure that DEP, you know, the Department of Environmental Protection, knows exactly how much is permitted. Or
I don't remember if I mentioned this last time we talked, but I grew up in Colorado, and we would go up in the mountains all the time, and there were mine tailings from the 1870s that still have nothing growing on them. I mean, there's still moonscapes. Mm-hmm. 140. This is the 1970s, so 100 years later at that point, and presumably still are. I just haven't been back, but at least 100 years later, there's still moonscapes. This is
right.
This is. I mean, everything you're saying is just breaking my heart.
I know. I've said that before. That's what my job is to break people's hearts. You know, because it really is. It's heartbreaking, and then it's. You know, there's folks who are vehemently opposed to our work, basically because there's, you know, no other income at the moment for folks, because, you know, basically politicians have been so happy keeping this area, this mono economy, and keeping people, you know, like in servitude to the coal industry.
Well,
so
it's
heartbreaking.
It seems pretty clear that if we go back to the time of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel,
mm-hmm.
and we go back to even the early coal mines, it's really been very clear that West Virginia has been a national sacrifice zone.
Yes. And in fact, there's a documentary out now, Blood on the Mountain, by Marilyn Evans and others that, you know, really delves into our history, including the Hawk's Nest Tunnel and the mines and all that. And we are like a national sacrifice zone here. But at the same time, you know, we still have amazing beauty, and we have, you know, resilient forest dwellers, and, you know, we're some people are digging in their heels and refusing to see that, you know, the coal industry is on the way out. And, you know, some politicians see it. So, gee, what are they thinking we should substitute it with? Oh, hey, how about drilling, you know, deep shale, and let's screw the water that way. And, you know, now they're even talking about the Rogersville Shale, which is like 20,000 feet or, I don't know, 14 to 20,000 feet deep. It's, you know, another, let's replace one insane extraction energy with a new, perhaps even more insane, because it's going to, you know, all sorts of areas, and a wider swath of West Virginia is now facing the intense scrutiny for shale drilling.
So we have just a couple minutes left. How can people help you, and how can people help the forests of and hills and mountains and humans and non-humans of West Virginia? How can people help?
Well, you know, of course, I'm going to plug our group, join our group, or look up online and join one of the small West Virginia groups or several of us. Send a donation to help keep us working. And, you know, come visit here. Come tell our politicians that you love the beautiful part of West Virginia. You love the emerging, you know, local food movement, the solar hauler, Mountain View Solar, the Coalfield Development Corporation, these places that are, you know, thinking about and envisioning a changing West Virginia. And, you know, help our politicians see that it's time to envision a future that has some level of sanity.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program again. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Vivian Stockman. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.